Last time I was talking about these theories that have... hang on a second. Don't want to drop my notes. Last time I was talking about these theories that have 16 supercharges. And I explained that one of the ways to get theories with 16 supercharges was to take either of the heterotic theories, the ones with gauge groups E8 cross E8 or spin 32 mod Z2, and you formulate them on a torus of dimension 9 minus D crossed with Minkowski space with D spatial dimensions, D plus 1 spacetime dimensions. And that produced a space which was described as O... Well, 9 minus D, 16 plus 9 minus D, mod O 9 minus D cross O 16 plus 9 minus D, modded out by a discrete group, which is the symmetries of some even unimodular lattice of the corresponding signature, 9 minus D, 16 plus 9 minus D. Now, in the course of doing that, I described a kind of cross R plus, which is the dilaton. Now, in the course of doing that, I kind of described the data here somewhat geometrically from the point of view of conformal field theory. I described the structure that we had found that we might use to specify it as being the choice of a metric on the torus. So that would have been GL 9 minus D mod O 9 minus D. And then I had to choose a B field, a harmonic two form, modulo integral two forms. And then I had to choose a bundle on the torus, and I described the data for that as R9 minus D tensored with R16. And the natural discrete symmetry group that you had to take into account in this case, I made a slight error in, which is why I'm going over it again. So I've got to take the lattice, I have to take the Z 9 minus D tensor Z16 lattice here. But what I neglected last time was that I also have to act on that lattice by a copy of the vowel group of the gauge group G. So here G is either E8 cross E8 or spin 32 mod Z2. And this R16, or rather this Z16, is the Cartan is the lattice that's the fundamental group of, say, a Cartan torus inside that group. And I've got to act on that lattice by this vowel group as well. Then there's also the translations in the wedge to Z9 minus D direction, and then all that was semi-direct product with the diffeomorphism group here, GL 9 minus DZ. Sorry, I guess it was a mistake to use 9 minus D. Yesterday's strategy of using K was a little more clear in terms of all the notation. So it was this vowel group action, which I forgot last time, and I wanted to point that out. What happens when the monodromy of... Which monodromy? Right. So we're actually assuming in the spin 32 minus Z2 case, we'll assume it's liftable. And maybe there's another component of the maps which are not liftable to spin 32. No, if the non-liftable maps do not map to a maximal torus. Let's see. So I'm going to specify a bundle by specifying two elements that tell me the monodromy transformations, and they must commute. D and 9 minus D commuting elements. So they're simultaneously commuting. You can map them into a torus. You can conjugate them. I thought a Cartan subgroup is a maximal abelian group in the sense that any abelian group can be embedded into a maximal. No. Uh-huh. So there's something else to check there. Where's John? John's thought a lot about this. Well, maybe we'll ask it again when John comes back. Okay, well, anyway, except for some questions like this, we have this description of the parameter space, and I wanted to give a kind of alternate description, a much more geometric description, in the case of 9 minus d equals 2, so the case that I'm compactifying on a 2 torus. So what I have to do in compactifying on a 2 torus, I have two elements which hopefully I really can conjugate into the Cartan torus. Now, let's see. I just discovered a horrible notational problem. So let me call it C for Cartan torus. Well, really, I had two group elements to begin with. G1 and G2 in the group, I would try to look at the pair G1, G2 up to simultaneous conjugacy. And I guess two elements I can put in the torus. Yes? Is there any question about that? Simply connected groups. Okay, fine. I'm actually wanting to, yeah, it's a liftable map, but I'm actually wanting to focus on E8 cross E8 today, so let's do that. So the pair G1 mod G2 at the conjugacy can be conjugated into a pair where I take G1, G2 within this some chosen Cartan torus, but there's still an ambiguity, and the ambiguity is by the action of the Weyl group. So the natural parameters would be to think of this pair as being an element of C cross C mod the Weyl group of E8 cross E8. In fact, I can split these up separately. I can sort of take two E8 bundles. There's no interaction between these E8 bundles in this particular instance. So I can really think of G11, G21 as defining one. So maybe I should call this C1 as defining an element in one copy of that torus, and G1, G21, G22 as being an element in another copy of the same space. So, yes. No. This is the compact form of E8. Right. So this is a. It's the torus. C is the torus. It should be called T, but T is the torus on which I'm compactifying, so I can't use T. C is for Cartan. That's so algebraic geometers like to study these bundles in a slightly different way. There's a theorem of Narasimhan and Seshadri. Originally of Narasimhan and Seshadri in the case of vector bundles. I'm actually not sure who the extension is due to general groups. So this is the generalized Narasimhan-Seshadri theorem, which tells us that, say, principal bundles, principal G bundles, with a flat connection on a Riemann surface, sigma, correspond in a natural way to semi-stable bundles up to what's called S-equivalence. So you have to be careful what equivalence relationship you put among bundles which are only semi-stable and not stable. Semi-stable bundles up to S-equivalence with structure group GC, the complexification of the group on the Riemann surface sigma. So holomorphic semi-stable bundles. So this is the way that that physicists tend to describe these things as a bundle with connection, but algebraic geometers are very familiar with this kind of translation between the theory of flat connections and the theory of holomorphic structures on the bundle, with this nice dictionary in which you allow stable or semi-stable bundles up to an appropriate kind of equivalence corresponding to flat connections. Connections become reducible precisely at the places where instead of a stable bundle, you get a semi-stable bundle. So, as I say, it was originally done for vector bundles, and it was later extended to G-bundles. So, for the purposes of describing some of this data in a way that's quite concrete and can be done using algebraic geometry instead of, for example, having to use invariant theory for the vowel group of E8, which is rather painful, we might try to follow this approach and describe these bundles, these holomorphic bundles. So let me tell you the results of Loyangha and Friedman Morgan Witten. Which enable one to describe what these bundles look like for a certain nice class of groups. So let me consider the E series groups, which appeared yesterday. But now in compact form. I'll take the compact real forms of these groups. So I remind you that these groups were obtained from things called Delpezzo surfaces. So such a group is associated to S, which is a Delpezzo surface. And we had the class of the anti-canonical class of the Delpezzo surface, which is a class in the second cohomology. We took its orthogonal complement, and its orthogonal complement was the was supposed to be pi 1 of the Cartan torus of the group that we wanted to study. So again, if I do the compact real form, that's the accurate version of the statement. And then by looking inside that space for elements of square length minus 2, we found roots and could reconstruct the entire algebra in terms of the roots. Pardon? Simply connected. That's right. So here's the construction. Well, what are these Delpezzo? What do we know about the anti-canonical divisors of these Delpezzo surfaces? Well, we know that when S is a Delpezzo surface, this such an anti-canonical divisor, this is represented by a family of elliptic curves, D sub T, T living in some projective space, minus some discriminant locus. So if I want smooth elliptic curves, I need to remove some of the points from that thing, which, in fact, in the cases of sufficiently high degree, are generic hyperplane sections. With respect to the embedding of the Delpezzo surface into large dimensional space. But in the generalized form of the Delpezzo surface that I discussed yesterday, I just have to look at this family of curves, the generic one of which is a smooth elliptic curve. And what I can do is I can define a C bundle. So C is this Cartan torus. I can define a C bundle on this elliptic curve E sub t by restricting the line bundles associated to elements of this lattice to E. So I might have gotten a dual. I might have mixed up something with its dual here, and I apologize if I did that. But what I need, if this is the pi 1 of the Cartan torus, or possibly its dual, what I need is a line bundle specified for each of these elements. And so I can get such a bundle by using the natural line bundle. So Lx is the associated line bundle on X, on S, excuse me. Every element in H2 of S is of type 1-1. So there are associated line bundles on these Delpeza surfaces. And you just restrict the line bundle to the elliptic curve. You get a degree zero line bundle on the elliptic curve. It's degree zero because we're in this orthogonal complement of this class. And that collection of degree zero line bundles specifies a C bundle over this elliptic curve. Moreover, the Weyl group of the group, the associated group G, preserves this structure. And we get a point. We get, in a natural way, a point in the moduli space of G bundles. So G is now this E series of groups that I'm mentioning. So this turns out to describe, well, in the case of G equals E8, this precisely describes the moduli space. In the lower cases, like E7 and E6 and so on, there's some finite ambiguity which can be analyzed precisely, but which affects the final answer about the description of the moduli space. I'm sorry. So K is represented by any member of the family. So what I'm wanting to do, so since I wanted to work on a Riemann surface, I should pick a complex structure on the elliptic curve. Now I want to embed the elliptic curve into the Delpeza surface, choose one, and now on that elliptic curve, I will restrict this family of line bundles. And it's a... Now I vary, that's right, I vary the complex structure on S, essentially. So, or the embedding. That's correct. That's correct. I'm mainly interested in the E8 case where there's actually not any continuous moduli for the embedding because it's a one-parameter family of elliptic curves. There are other interesting geometric constructions which can be made for other kinds of G bundles, but the description that I want to give of what's happening in the E8 cross E8 heterotic string, I'll need the associated Delpeza surface for E8. So the Delpeza surface is of degree 1. From what I told you yesterday, that's the blow-up of P2 at 8 points in general position. This family of elliptic curves that I mentioned is the set of all, well, it comes from the set of all degree 3 curves, set of all cubic curves, through these 8 points. And it's parameterized by P1. Well, again, if I want a non-singular curve, you'll see that when you take the degree 3 curve through 8 generic points, that at a certain number, in fact, 12, of the parameter values, you'll get a singularity in the vibration if everything is completely generic. So out of the data of such an elliptic curve sitting inside of this particular S, I'm able to determine an E8 bundle on this torus, which through Narasimhan Seshadri is equivalent to a principal E8 bundle with a flat connection. I should point out that the intersection of ET and ET prime is a point P inside this Scalpezzo surface, which is a point that's independent of T. The degree one, so these elliptic curves represent this anti-canonical class. Its self-intersection is one in this particular case, and this is how you geometrically realize that self-intersection. And that point represents the ninth common point of intersection of any pair of these three curves that are passing through the specified 8 points. So, in fact, the geometric data that I have, I don't have to specify the point P in advance, but I do end up with a point P on this elliptic curve. And perhaps the most efficient way of describing what I've gotten at the end is to now blow up S at P. The blow up of S at P is now a rational elliptic surface with a section. By blowing it up, so the picture was that I had all these elliptic curves passing through a common point. When I blow it up, I now have the elliptic curves all separated from each other, and that common point has been replaced by a copy of P1, which is a section for the vibration. So I get a rational elliptic surface with section. And rational elliptic surfaces with section can be described by equations. I haven't specified an origin, so I'll take this as the origin. And now I can make a Weierstrass model. And you find, putting that section at infinity, that there's an equation of the form which can be taken to have the form y squared equals x cubed plus a polynomial of degree 4 in some parameter t times x plus a polynomial of degree 6, a polynomial g of degree 6 in t, where f4 of t and g6 of t are polynomials. And where t goes to infinity, say, represents the fixed elliptic curve that we started with. Now, the data here, f4 of t and g4 of t, you have to mod out by some equivalence. There's not a completely unique way of putting it in this form. In particular, I can make affine changes of coordinates in T without changing the fact that I've got my fixed elliptic curve. And I can also do a little bit of rescaling, common rescaling of appropriate type in X and Y. I have to mod out by those equivalences. But this gives a very concrete way of representing the data that's needed to specify an E8 bundle on a two torus. So, a rational elliptic surface over P1, initially I take F and G to be sections of L to the 4 and L to the 6, but it's over P1, and so that's just represented by quartic and sextic polynomials. So this is a very geometric, algebra geometric version of the story of what these things look like. Well, I ran through it because we're going to run into another very similar story from a completely different perspective in a couple of minutes.
So the bottom line is that it's just the choice of polynomial
F4 and G4 modulo the equivalences, which essentially can be described by T goes to AT plus B, and also I could do the rescalings. XY goes to lambda squared X lambda cubed Y. Pardon? That's the moduli space of flat EA bundles if you leave out the appropriate discriminant locus. Yes. Well, that's the union of all the moduli spaces of flat EA bundles with varying J invariant. And you have to sort of say, you have to calculate the J invariant at infinity for this thing to say, if you were fixing the J invariant, which one you got. So, right, I wanted to fix an elliptic curve within the Del Pezzo surface, and I put that out at infinity. But now, to actually say what the moduli is, you should separate out the J invariant parameter from the other parameters. So this is the union of all those moduli spaces together. So it's combined moduli. So the combined moduli. That's right, exactly. Right. Well, 12. 12, yes? Right. Yeah, so I should modify that also, I guess. Right. And then some discrete group. Well, I now want to return to the other way of looking at theories with 16 supercharges. And I want to look at them via, say, N theory or type 2A theory, compactified on spaces of the form a K3 cross some kind of torus cross whatever residual Minkowski space I might have. So I guess the rule is D plus 5 plus K is equal to 10 or 11, depending on whether I was doing M or 2A. So we worked out in some detail the story in seven dimensions last time. We worked out the story with M theory compactified on, or formulated on, K3 cross M16. And we found there this description in terms of the symmetric space for O319, which suggested this minus some discriminant locus, which we understood then as related to points of enhanced gauge symmetry, modulo this discrete group. And we were then led to the string-string duality conjecture that this should be related to the heterotic string compactified on a 3-torus. I want to go back up one dimension, and to do that, I need to take what's called the F-theory limit of these theories. So to find this F-theory limit, what I want to do is choose an embedding of what's called the hyperbolic plane, the even unimodular lattice of signature 1, 1. It's got an intersection form that looks like 0, 1, 1, 0. I choose an embedding of that into this lattice lambda 319, which was the second cohomology of K3 with integer coefficients. Now, choosing an embedding like this, there's going to be a decomposition somewhat similar to the decompositions that we've been looking at earlier, which, if you looked at it on the heterotic side, would just be a decompactification limit of the heterotic string. So there will be a decomposition associated to this where instead of where I decompose this symmetric space on 319, I keep forgetting the R plus. I decompose the symmetric space on O319 in terms of a space on O218, and then some appropriate R to the N. This defines a parabolic subgroup, and this is some KAN type decomposition with respect to that parabolic subgroup. I guess I should split off a certain R plus as part of this story. And this is how you would go step by step instead of all at once from the theories compactified on a 2-torus, say, to the theories compactified on a 3-torus. So the question becomes, what is this? What represents this kind of limit and this kind of decomposition if we study the theories on K3 surfaces? Well, this limit, in fact, is represented or is approached by families of metrics, of Ricci flat metrics, Gij of t, with the property that the volume of Gij of t remains constant as you vary the family, but the area of the minimal representative of a particular class E in lambda 1, 1 goes to 0. So here I choose a class E in lambda 1, 1. Actually, I needed to make this choice, not just this embedding, but a choice of a particular class E in order to do this decomposition. I choose a class E in lambda 1, 1 such that E dot E is equal to 0. Now, as I discussed last time, the minimal area representatives of E actually corresponds to some Riemann surfaces with respect to an appropriate complex structure. And in fact, in this case, the genus of the Riemann surface is equal to 1, and there's a one-parameter family of these Riemann surfaces. Those are facts in algebraic geometry which can be derived purely from this intersection condition. Moreover, I have another class, F, in lambda 1, 1, such that F intersected with E is equal to 1. And by restricting the path a bit, we can assume that E and F are simultaneously algebraic classes. Well, what's true is that I can get out to the limit along such paths. And so I'm going to treat the paths that stay along, that preserve this condition, as sort of the good ones for going out to the limit, and we'll treat the discrepancy between the places where E and F would be algebraic as a different parameter that has to be accounted for somehow in doing this analysis. For the purposes of analyzing this particular end of the moduli space, where I choose a parabolic associated to this structure, then that's determined by a primitive embedding of 0, 1, 1, 0 into the lattice. It's a very interesting question. What happens to paths which keep E and F prime simultaneously algebraic, where F prime dot E is equal to N instead of E dot F is algebraic? But
that's another family.
That's another family. I don't need that to analyze this problem. Well, now I'm in a pretty good situation because algebraically, again, I want to translate things today to algebraic geometry where I can. Algebraically, what I have is a K3 surface with an elliptic fibration with section. And the general theory of elliptic fibrations on algebraic surfaces I can apply, just as they did over there, to find that this can be represented as y squared equals x cubed plus fa of tx plus g12 of t, where now f8 and g12 are, again, polynomials in one variable of degrees 8 and 12. Generally speaking, in order to produce surfaces with these elliptic vibrations with section, you would take Weierstrass equations of this type. I actually want to work over a compact base, so more naturally, I should be working over P1 instead of C1. And then you need to take sections of line bundles to a second and a third, or rather a fourth and a sixth power, and use those sections of line bundles to construct the elliptic fibration. Here I'm arbitrarily choosing some point so that I can write it as polynomials, the sections of the fourth, the eighth and twelfth powers of the hyperplane bundle on P1 can be written as polynomials of degrees 8 and 12, and then I can write an equation which looks fairly standard. This time I allow fractional linear transformations when I try to discuss the moduli space. So I'll take the F8 G12s, and I'll allow T to be changed by AT plus B divided by CT plus D instead of simply looking at affine transformations, because I don't have a distinguished fiber in the fibration, unlike the case over there, but then the other equivalences are similar. So the algebra geometric description of this data can be written this way. It can also be written, as you might expect from what I said, as an open subset in a space related to O2, 18. So again, I have to take out some subset of quote-unquote bad points, but the non-singular K3s, which have elliptic vibrations of this sort, have admitted description of this nature. Yeah?
On the heteronic side, you're decompactifying from 7 dimensions to 8.
That's right.
And on the stem theory side, you're approaching your K3 is approaching a vibration where I guess the base of the fiber is small.
That's right. So the total volume is constant. The fiber in the vibration is becoming small, and that means that the base is simultaneously growing, right? That's exactly what's happening. So what's the interpretation of this kind of limit where we're squeezing down on this elliptic vibration, making the fiber smaller and smaller while keeping the volume constant, and, of course, exploiting an equation like this to tell us the detailed nature of that vibration as we're going along? Well, I remind you of an equation that I wrote down in the first lecture, which told the relationship between M-theory on a two-torus and type 2B on a circle. And the relationship was that tau, the ratio of periods of the two-torus, which is related to the J invariant and can be completely calculated out of data of this sort, was related to the complexified dilaton directly on the 2B side and was independent of S1. And the area was related to the length of the compactifying circle on the B side in a very specific way. That length is the area to the minus 3/4. So when I'm looking at M theory compactified on, say, one of these tori in this family, and I shrink down the size of the area of that torus, if I were to give a 2B interpretation to that compactification, I would discover that the compactifying circle on the 2B side is getting large and is effectively decompactifying. So that's the idea behind F theory. What I want to do is take this P1. AM was the area of the two torus in M theory units, and LB was the length of the circle in 2B units. So I want to take this P1, which after all is a two-sphere. I want to remove the points where the elliptic vibration degenerates. I point out that it's not possible to have an elliptic vibration without some singular fibers occurring if you're going to make up something like a K3 surface. Anytime you're going to get, in fact, topological Euler number non-zero out of a vibration structure like this, you need to allow singular fibers. There's an unfortunate clash between topologists' words for vibration and fiber bundle and algebraic geometers' words, but I use vibration like an algebraic geometer does, where I allow some singular fibers to occur. So I should remove those singular fibers. Maybe I'll remove a small neighborhood of each of those singular fibers. And then I have a locally trivial, I have a topologically locally trivial bundle of two tori. And I could hope that this duality, which I understand works for a single two torus, would also work in families. So apply the M to B duality in families. Now, applying this duality in families is a slightly tricky business. In particular, you have to wonder that about the fact that although you could locally trivialize this fibration over small open sets or over simply connected open sets, there's in fact some non-trivial monodromy action as you go around some of these singular fibers. So if this idea is really going to work, we need to explain what's happening near those singular points, and we need to relate it to the monodromy that we're seeing in the singular fibers. And you'll notice that tau, well, so for simplicity, I'm going to assume that the elliptic fibration is at the very worst stable and sometimes I'll assume that it's a Lefschetz pencil. So this assumption is the most restrictive, and it says that only the simplest types of singularities are allowed. Yeah. So the stable fibrations are cases in which no component appears with high multiplicity in the singular fiber, and moreover, there are normal crossing singularities at each of the components. So the only possibility for stable fibers are these kind of polygons built out of CP1s. This is the simplest case where you make a sort of one-gon. You just wrap the CP1 back on itself with a double point. So here, any size polygons are allowed. Here, just a single case. Yeah?
You're starting originally with a K3?
Starting with a K3. That's right. Right.
So this assumption, there are sort of various...
Oh, so I mean, the easiest way to run along the limit is to fix the complex structure, which will fix the structure of this vibration, and treat the moduli of the vibration separately from this limit that I'm taking where I shrink down the size of the elliptic fiber. So if I'm doing that, then I'll perturb F and G to generic values when it actually only has these Lefschetz type of fibers. Yes, I'll get to that. It's important. Well, I right now, actually, I'm varying the metric, not the complex structure. I'm actually holding the complex structure fixed, and I'm varying the metric. So, right, I just want the area of the elliptic fiber to go to zero. But I'll have to look at some degenerations of... I'm moving in the Kähler cone only. So I'll have to look at some degenerations of complex structures in a few minutes, and I'll show you an interesting degeneration of that kind. So whenever I have a fiber of this sort, the monodromy around this fiber is of the form tau goes to tau plus 1, if I've chosen a basis of periods appropriately. So it's anyway conjugate to that transformation. So this tau parameter is definitely not a constant, as I already mentioned, in this situation. I have to have some ability to vary the tau parameter in order to construct these theories. And that's quite unusual from the 2B perspective. So if I've tried to map this over to the complexified dilaton in 2B, it says that the complexified dilaton is not constant. In fact, this kind of monodromy indicates that there must be some kind of source for the Ramon-Ramon scalar. At the singular point. And that's exactly provided by a seven brain. we heard about brains as sources, or I think the upshot of the lunchtime conversation yesterday was that brains need to be called sources rather than that other S word. So here's what Vafa proposed. He proposed that we should be able to build compactifications of, so now I want to represent my P1 really more like a two-sphere. He proposed that we should be able to build compactifications or of the 2B theory on spaces B with seven brains inserted into the background. And the seven brain should be inserted along the locus where the elliptic vibration degenerates. Sorry, I did not start this sentence well. So if I'm given some elliptic vibration, x to b, an elliptic vibration with a section, there should exist a compactification of the type 2B theory on the space B, where we've inserted seven brains along the locus where the elliptic vibration degenerates. And the insertion of those seven brains means that when you analyze the behavior of the complexified dilaton around monodromy loops, you will precisely reproduce and I should have said, and variable complexified dilaton according to the elliptic vibration. So you'll precisely reproduce the variation that you expected from the elliptic vibration structure within the dilaton if you go around this brain. Now, what that means is a little strange because what you think is the 2B string at one place changes its identity when you wander around these moduli paths. So you're really taking in different regions of this spacetime different fundamental strings, and then you're using the S-duality of type 2B theory to identify the theories with these different strings as identified as fundamental strings and kind of glue them together someplace, having chopped this thing up, perhaps. So it's a very strange way of compactifying a theory. Nevertheless, because it's exactly what you seem to be getting from the 2B, from the M theory on K3 perspective, and particularly because you would have expected to see a decompactification in the heterotic dual side, this seems to be a reasonable model of what's going on in eight dimensions now as a limit of these K3 surfaces. Now, I said that I got, if I restricted the fibers to be the very simplest kind, then I got a monodromy which is conjugate to tau goes to tau plus 1, and that was what I expected to find from a single 7 brain. So a natural question is what happens if the 7 brains come together and I want them to come together let me say, come together generically. I'll explain what that means in just a minute. So the generic answer of what happens when 7 brains come together from the side of geometry is that you have one of these stable fibers, so this would be the case of a stable fiber, which, as you vary the complex structure parameters, splits up into, if you had an n-gon, it will split up into n of the simple type of fibers. So here you had a single point, and here you had n of these points close together, and that's the basic geometry of how you can sort of generically bring some of these singular points together. The locations of the singular points, by the way, are measured by the so-called discriminant of this equation, which, if I'm not mistaken, with this normalization is F8 cubed over 27 minus G12 squared plus G12 squared over 4 up to some numerical factors or something. So So you would make a calculation of that thing that has 24 zeros generically, which is where you would have expected your 24 brains to come from. I needed 24 to cancel the anomalies in the eight-dimensional theory from the 2B perspective, by the way. So there's a sort of independent check of that number. And then one of the ways, sort of the most natural way of bringing them together, is to construct fibrations where you would get one of these stable fibers, and then you discover when you perturb the parameters a little bit, what used to be a multiple root of this discriminant expression splits apart into a collection of single roots. So that's the geometry of stable fibers and varying the parameters in stable fibers. Pardon? The 24 can be calculated by looking at some anomaly computation in the eight-dimensional theory. If you were just building things this way and wanting to know when you could have an anomaly-free theory. So that's what happens in the from the perspective of geometry. From the perspective of physics, well, from the perspective of physics, we just have N seven brains on top of each other. We know that N seven brains on top of each other leads to an SUN factor in gauge symmetry. And we also know that those brains can then be separated and would split up into N brains with now massive vectors corresponding to open strings that join up the brains, which become massless when you bring the positions of the brains together. So there's a very nice matchup between these stable fibers and their behavior and N of these seven brains coming on top of each other, in which you learn that there's an SUN factor in the gauge symmetry. Now, I neglected to mention that here there's one other feature of the geometry, which is, so back to the geometry, which is that this equation, the y squared equals x cubed plus f of tx plus g of t equation, actually has a singularity in the case of a stable fiber. So I've drawn the stable fiber this way, and that's the non-singular representative of the stable fiber, but if the section in the fibration passes through this particular component, if that's where the section goes, then in this geometric model that we're using, with described by this equation, all of the remaining components are contracted to a singular point. So there's some singular point, actually this is now joined up, there's some singular point located here, the section passes through here, and that singular point is, in the classification of these things called rational double points that I mentioned yesterday, is something called type A n minus 1.
But this is in the
S-theory limit, the volumes of these other... All right, so, yeah, so I should have commented on this a little bit better. Since these are all components of the fiber, I'm going to have to shrink all of them down to zero area. I have no choice about that when I'm shrinking down the entire thing to zero area. And so the sort of easiest way to see what's going on is to first shrink down all but the component meeting the section to zero area, and then to go to the F-theory limit. You could equally well just take the whole thing down at once, but it's a little harder to see. It's a choice of paths. That's right. That's right. So I can take a path which sort of first shrinks down those to zero area and then goes out to the F-theory limit. If I do it that way, then as I argued yesterday, shrinking down an AN minus 1 singularity produces an SUN gauge symmetry already in 8 dimensions. And now I'm following a path where I have this SUN in 8 dimensions, where the massless non-abelian gauge bosons came by wrapping things around these contracted components. And what that's approaching is an SUN in, this is 7 dimensions, an SUN in 8 dimensions, where the dual interpretation would be the usual story about massless loops of string going between the infinitesimally separated N copies of a brain. Well, that does not exhaust the list of what can happen to an elliptic vibration on a surface. In fact, the study of what can happen was done by Kodaira in the early 60s. So these are degenerate fibers in elliptic vibrations with section. And there's some label that's traditional. By saying with section, I just leave out one or two cases from this list. There's some label which is traditional. I draw a picture of the fiber. So the stable fiber is called I sub n, or 1 sub n. The singularity in the Weierstrass model, so here's the smooth fiber, non-singular. Here's the fiber on the non-singular surface. Here's the singularity on the Weierstrass model. And I also want to tell you the monodromy transformation on the periods. So the monodromy on the periods, well, exactly what we expect. We expect bringing n of these brains together in the way that we've been discussing would produce exactly this kind of n-fold source, a charge n object, as we heard yesterday, from the brain perspective. And I guess I should say what the associated gate symmetry is, just for completeness here. So we'll get an SUN factor in the gate symmetry that way. And of course, I sub 1 is included, which doesn't give any gate symmetry enhancement. Then there are cases called 2, 3, and 4. 2 is a curve with a cusp. 3 is two curves which are tangent to each other. And 4 is three rational curves which meet in a point. There's no singularity in the Weierstrass equation here. There's an A1 and an A2 here. And the monodromies here are order 6, order 4, and order 3. And there's no enhanced gate symmetry here. And here I have an SU2, and here I have an SU3. Then I get some cases called IN star. Well, the picture gets a little complicated looking. Anyway, some funny chain of things with pairs of rational curves on the end. The singularity in the Weierstrass model is of type D it's of type D. And I'll tell you what the D is in just a minute. And the gate symmetry is for this guy is SO2n+8. So D has to be n+4. But this n is 0 when this guy, yeah, that's right. That's right. And then I've got 2 star, 3 star, and 4 star. And, well, these are familiar graphs. I'm going to just write E8 tilde. That's the Dinkin diagram of the affine E8 group. E7 tilde and E6 tilde. It's easier to write them that way than to draw them. And the singularity in the Weierstrass models are E8, E7, and E6. And the monodromies are order 6, order 4, and order 3. These are different monodromy transformations, right? There are two elements of order 6, two elements of order 4, and two elements of order 3, which occur in SL2Z. And here, naturally enough, we're going to claim the gate symmetry becomes E87 and E6. So the argument about the correctness of the gate symmetry in these cases and these cases at the moment has to be made by following one of these special paths that I mentioned. Namely, we can see all the gauge bosons in the K3 case in 7 dimensions, and then we could follow the path with the enhanced gate symmetry already present and argue that as in the two cases that are pretty well understood, we wouldn't expect the gauge symmetry to change during the process of decompactification along such a path. I don't know of a real solid argument other than that, and also comparison with the heterotic dual in favor of these identifications of the gauge symmetry. This case is kind of nice because this case has a model of taking an orientifold plane with N seven brains stuck on it. And there's some way in brain theory of modeling that where it becomes clear that SO2N plus 8 is exactly the gauge symmetry algebra that you would have expected. And so that one is in somewhat better shape. So these are the two cases where tau is going to I infinity and you're getting infinite order monodromy. Somebody asked me the question during the first lecture, what happens at the special points of the 2B moduli space? And the answer is really interesting things must be happening. These are the tau values go to those special values, and the existence of these order 3, 4, and 6 monodromies are related to the strange structures at those places. And some very unusual things happen in these 2B theories with variable dilaton, where, among other things, you could produce E67 and E8 enhanced gauge symmetry by appropriately choosing models of variable dilaton near those points. So that's the basic picture of F-theory. Now, when I do F-theory models in eight dimensions, as I've been doing today, all of the singular points are isolated. Each one of them has a classification. I mean, each one of them has some monodromy. And in fact, this is the monodromy up to conjugacy, of course. And these are all the conjugacy classes of monodromy that can occur. So you can read off by, for example, just looking at the monodromy, exactly what kind of singular fiber, singularity in the Weierstrass model, and gauge symmetry you would expect to find for those models. However, if this principle works for constructing compactifications, then it should also work for higher dimensional compactifying spaces. So if I look at elliptic vibrations not just on K3 surfaces but on Calabi-Yau's of higher dimension, then I should also be able to make models with a lower models essentially compactified on the base using 2B theory and using the tau of the elliptic vibration to specify the behavior of the dilaton in the 2B theory. But then this whole story about what's happening with the brains becomes more complicated because the place that you want to insert the brains includes not just isolated points on the compact space, but whole subvarieties around which you have to wrap the brains. And there are all sorts of interesting issues about maybe gauge fields living on the brains playing a role, monodromy of these structures playing a role, and I hope I will get to some of those issues a little bit later on. Well, for the detailed comparison, so I should say that the earlier dualities that I talked about before starting to discuss the string-string duality are really dualities which help to relate in very high dimensions the various physical theories that have been found that are variants of this basic idea of string theory. But it's when we got down to string-string duality and started relating K3 compactifications on the one hand to heterotic compactifications on the other hand that we started to find some rather remarkable implications for geometry. And some of these can be checked and other ones become new predictions about geometry. So one of the themes that I want to emphasize is that string-string duality has some remarkable implications for geometry. And these implications I'm very fond of, in part because unlike mirror symmetry, which is the other discovery in string theory that had some remarkable implications for geometry that got me interested in the field, many of the implications which are made for string-string duality are quite accessible. We're not comparing apples and oranges. We're not sort of relating periods on one manifold to Gromov-Witten invariants on some other manifold. We're doing some rather interesting geometric constructions, and if you analyze them closely, you find some rather interesting connections between different areas of mathematics which can be approached pretty directly. So I want to start to indicate what those implications are up here in eight dimensions by giving a more geometric version of the parameter matching between, on the one hand, the heterotic theory compactified on T2, and on the other hand, these F-theory models built on elliptic K3s. One small footnote. I never mentioned 12 dimensions. It's very tempting to speculate that this eight-dimensional model, which is built out of a four-manifold, this elliptically fibered K3, must be a 12-dimensional theory compactified on the four-manifold. And some people have tried to pursue that, and there's some interesting partial results in that direction. But it's not necessary to assume or believe that in order to study these F-theory models. These F-theory models can be treated as compactifications of 2B with variable dilaton on the base of this fibration, where the fiber was really only used to specify how the dilaton was to vary. And its geometric origin is sort of forgotten other than that. Okay, but we would like now a geometric version of this parameter matching between these heterotic theories here and the F-theory models there. And really, in order to get an accurate description of the compactification of the heterotic theory, remember what we did. We sort of took the metric here, and then we had the B field, and then we had the bundle data, and then we sort of modded out by geometric equivalence. And of course, it's crossed the dilaton. And for this to be a good description, we need to be at large values of the expansion parameter here, which is actually given by the volume of T2. So we want the volume or the area of the T2 should be large to get a good expansion parameter here. That's the limit in which we would expect this decomposition to be natural, and we would expect to only see the geometric equivalences playing a role. And we could then hope that that geometric version of the bundle data that I gave in terms of a Del-Petzl surface might play some role. So the question is, what is the corresponding limit over here? I focused on the E8 cross E8 case in part because that limit is much more clear, although Paul Aspinwall and I last spring figured out what the corresponding limit is for the spin 32 mod Z2. But the E8 cross E8 case, where the limit was given by Friedman, Morgan, and Witten, the limit is very clear. The picture that I've had was of P1 with K3 fibration, which, among other things, for generic values of the parameters, involved 24 singular fibers. Now, one of the things which I can do to such a fibration is I can deform the P1 to break it in half. So if that looks a little unusual, all you have to really consider is what happens if you represent the P1 as the solutions of a quadratic equation in P2, and then you vary, actually, that's not the best choice, quadratic equation in P2, and then you vary the parameters in the quadratic equation until you acquire a singular point. And when you've acquired a singular point, you end up with two lines instead of a connected curve. This doesn't look connected, but it is in the complex plane. So something like xy plus tz squared is a one-parameter family going from something like this to something like this. Well, what can I do with my Weierstrass equation? My Weierstrass equation involves a degree 8 polynomial and a degree 12 polynomial. And in fact, what I can do is split things up so that I get a degree 4 polynomial here. This 8 and 12, if I were representing things in terms of this conic, could have been given by a fourth-degree polynomial in the ambient space and a sixth-degree polynomial in the ambient space. And those would restrict to fourth and sixth-degree polynomials. Sorry, they were F and G. Fourth and sixth-degree polynomials on these two remaining P1s here. And if I did that, then 12 of my singular fibers would go here. 12 of my singular fibers would go here. They get counted with multiplicities, by the way, if you had these extra, these more complicated guys. Each one of these counts as a certain number of the other singular fibers. So I mean 12 counted with appropriate multiplicities. And I would have a nice degeneration of the K3 surface into, well, what do I get? I get a union of two surfaces. Both of them are elliptically fibered still. They're meeting along a specific elliptic curve, which is represented by this point of intersection, and which is an elliptic curve that has a common equation. So F and F1, G1, and F2, G2 are required to have basically the same limit when you take T1 and T2 go to infinity. This is T1 going to infinity, if you like, and T2 going to infinity. And what's happened is that my K3, elliptically fibered K3, has broken up into a union of two rational elliptic surfaces with a specific elliptic curve marked on the two rational elliptic surfaces with the same J invariant so that they can be glued together. There was also a section, and the section of this fibration becomes a common section of these guys, which is a point there. So I can now interpret this rational elliptic surface with section and the specified fiber as exactly the data that determines an E8 bundle on this elliptic curve, this specific elliptic curve. I can't call it E sub T because on the orange elliptic curve. This is a Del Pezzo, yes. Well, it's a blown up Del Pezzo. So if I want to get back to the Del Pezzo model, I blow down the section. And I blow down the section, all of these fibers pass through the same point, including the orange one. This was the marked point that I mentioned. And this is now the degree one Del Pezzo. So it's a rational elliptic with section and Del Pezzo are essentially equivalent data. Pardon? So to each of these things is associated an E8 bundle. And so I got an E8 cross E8 bundle. So this is the extremely pretty geometric identification between the data over here on the heterotic side. Now let's just review what the data is. In addition to the area, I was supposed to choose the area should have been complexified. So this was really the complexified area getting large. And so that data has to come in as some scale factor over on the other side. In addition to that, I had the remaining data needed to specify a complex structure on this two torus. But the complex structure is used here. So in this moduli space, I needed to know what the complex structure was. And then in addition, I needed to have an E8 cross E8 bundle on that particular elliptic curve. And I got it by these two Del Pezzo surfaces, and they glued together precisely into the singular limit of the K3 surface as you go along. So this is one of the pictures which provides very nice evidence for string-string duality. It's difficult to map, to match the parameters more exactly when you go back to the general K3 surface, because that will involve essentially the metric and B field data here, which is a little harder to make into algebraic geometry. That has to do with the parts of this story that aren't directly translated into algebraic geometry. Yet this picture suggests that there is some nice way of translating it into algebraic geometry that we haven't quite uncovered yet, where you'll see why, when you go further out into the moduli space, all the data that you need is encoded by this K3 moduli space. So I think I'm going to stop there for now. And then when I talk again later this afternoon, I'll go down in dimension and talk about some of these models with fewer supersymmetries and in lower dimension. Yeah?
In the heterotic side, you can think of the gauge bundle as kind of as part of the whole Kac-Moody structure, right, in theory. Where does the geometric analog come
Well, I only know partial answers to that question, and see, in this, in, well, I don't have a real good answer to this question. I mean, Greg and Jeff Harvey and I have been working on a partial answer to this question, which has to do with the behavior of the BPS algebras on the K3 surfaces in limits, such as this F-theory limit. And you see some nice affinization of the gauge algebra appearing, which is exactly what you would have expected, say, when you went from 8 to 7, as I was doing at one point. So in that sense, I guess that's part of an answer to your question. Other questions? Yeah.
Each seventh frame is a U1 data field.
That's right. I. The heterotic string has right.
And there are 24 set of frames.
That's right. I don't have a good explanation for that. I mean, I guess I have to think that some of them
it's not visual mortality.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, if I compute it by looking at sort of H2 instead of looking at the brains, then I get the right answer. And it's exactly the non-mutual locality. I mean, you're not allowed, for example, to move around these 24 points independently. And when you bring things together in non-generic ways, you don't just get these stable fibers, you get some other fibers, which is another reflection of this non-mutual locality. In fact, the rank of the group that you get in colliding things is not always equal. Well, is that right? Oh, I don't know how to count. I don't know how to count that. Well, I mean, what has to be true is that for some unknown reason, there's a relation between these charges. They're not completely independent. That non-complete independence is obviously closely related to the non-mutual locality of the corresponding strings. So, you know, I think they're all there, and I think you can have strings ending on them. You just have to count the actual U1 to the 20 charges correctly. And, you know, you might occasionally miss something as you sweep the geodesic along, as you're moving the points around, right? You might have some geodesic interrupted by ending on the wrong brain, but that's pretty rare, I think. I don't think that's, I could be wrong.
Is there a limit with the P1 that's very large? You talk about 24 brains independently, or is it different?
Well, the P1 is, the P1 in 2B units stays at sort of finite size. You could certainly try to take a limit in which it gets large, but I mean, again, it's only in a neighborhood of one of these brains that you understand what the fundamental string is. I mean, sorry, not even in a full neighborhood of one of these brains do you understand what the fundamental string is because of the monodromy there. So it's only sort of out away from the brain that you understand what a fundamental string is. So, yeah, I don't have a good answer. Other questions? Okay.